From Pacifico Radio, this is Democracy Now!
And we wouldn't be talking if we were all friends. I mean, the whole reason why we're talking is because we've been political enemies, you know, for the last how many years? 800, you know, 70 or whatever it is. And I think we need to change that.
Mary Nealis, how do you feel sitting across the table from Billy Hutchinson, part of a paramilitary force that targeted you, your family, your friends, killed people?
Well, I see Billy Hutchinson as part of the British war machine in the north of Ireland.
An unprecedented radio discussion between both sides of the political divide in Northern Ireland. And is history for sale? We look at corporate contributions to the Smithsonian. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. U.S. Defense Secretary William Cohen said today that some action has to be taken against Iraq. U.N. diplomats are leaving Iraq today with no indication the country is backing down in its confrontation with the United Nations over American weapons inspectors. The Senate passed yesterday a bill authorizing $268 billion in military spending. The bill authorized $331 million on B-2 bombers. Listen carefully this weekend to the talk shows and see if they raise the issue of the peace dividend. The Senate Judiciary Committee yesterday delayed indefinitely its vote on President Clinton's embattled choice to enforce civil rights. With many of the country's civil rights leaders looking on, Clinton's Democrats sought the postponement to gain time to find one more Republican vote they need to end the panel's stalemate and send Bill Lanley's name to the full Senate. One of the nation's leading civil rights lawyers, Lee was chosen to head the Civil Rights Division of the Justice Department and would be the first Asian American in the post. A Massachusetts state lawmaker troubled by the possibility that au pair Louise Woodward was wrongly convicted of murder changed his vote, effectively scuttling a proposal to reinstate the death penalty in Massachusetts. A preliminary House vote on the bill last week came out 81-79 in favor of the death penalty, but the bill died in an 80-80 tie last night when a little-known representative, Democrat John Slattery of Peabody, switched his vote. Massachusetts held its last execution in 1940. The state Supreme Judicial Court threw out the most recent capital punishment law in 1984. Aaron Lee Fuller was executed last night in the death chamber at the state prison in Huntsville, Texas. Earl Matthews is due to die by lethal injection in a South Carolina prison at 6 o'clock Eastern Standard Time today. If the execution is carried out as scheduled, Matthews will be the second prisoner to die in South Carolina in 1997, but the first to be executed before midnight. South Carolina prison officials, following the lead of Texas, have switched the time for executions from the early morning hours to 6 p.m. A Republican Congress member yesterday introduced a resolution asking Kuwait to pay for treatment of illnesses afflicting U.S. veterans of the Gulf War. John Duncan of Tennessee introduced the measure that asked the Emir of Kuwait for funds until such payment can be obtained from Iraq. A judge nominated for a slot on federal appeals court withdrew from consideration yesterday after admitting he lied when he said he was the brother of a boy killed by racist teenagers in 1963. U.S. District Judge James Ware said in a letter to President Clinton, "After a great deal of soul searching, I request that my nomination be withdrawn." He said, "I'm sorry my misstatements about my background have caused such unintended consequences." Ware had been nominated for a spot on the 9th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals in San Francisco. He said in earlier speeches and interviews he was the older brother of Virgil Ware, a 13-year-old black boy gunned down in Birmingham, Alabama, by two white teenagers who supported racial segregation. It was just after the Birmingham bombing of 1963. A group of Democratic House members criticized the Clinton administration yesterday for providing financial assistance to Indonesia without requiring the country to improve its human rights record. In a letter to Treasury Secretary Robert Rubin, a copy of which was released to the media, Massachusetts Congressmember Bonnie Frank urged the government to reject a multi-billion dollar international loan package and withdraw an additional $3 billion credit line that the U.S. is extending to Indonesia. The letter asked the administration to do so until and unless the government of Indonesia Indonesia agrees to improve its position on worker rights and stops its oppressive practices and shows respect for the people of East Timor. We're going to now go back for a minute to the Iraq story, where the Secretary General of the United Nations, Kofi Annan, is saying to Iraq that if they don't cooperate with the United Nations arms inspectors, he will end his personal intervention in the dispute. We're joined by Phyllis Bennis, who is a fellow at the IPS, which is the Institute for Policy Studies, a progressive think tank in Washington. Phyllis, what's going on here?
Well, essentially, Amy, the U.S. has given every negative incentive to Saddam Hussein regarding how sanctions might be ended. The U.N. resolutions say that the sanctions would be lifted when the monitors can establish that there are no more weapons of mass destruction being produced or stockpiled. But now the U.S. has moved the goalposts, as it has continued to do in the 7 years since the sanctions were reduced. Washington says no, that even if the monitors can certify that, they won't lift the sanctions anyway as long as Saddam Hussein is in power. So Saddam Hussein is starting to think, if the sanctions won't be lifted anyway, why should he comply?
Phyllis Bennis, thanks for the quick comment. That's some of the news at this hour. And later in the show, you're going to hear an unprecedented debate between two sides in the debate in Northern Ireland. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. A California business person announced a $20 million gift to the Smithsonian Institution this week, the largest single donation to the museum in its 151-year history. The Smithsonian says they would use the money from multi-millionaire real estate developer Kenneth Bering to improve the National Museum of Natural History. The $20 million gift is just the latest in a string of deals that the Smithsonian and many other cultural institutions nationwide have been making with wealthy businessmen and corporate America. This year, the Smithsonian launched its own credit card and joined with business titans such as Ross Perot to update some exhibition halls. And last month, the Smithsonian opened a new exhibit called Oil from the Arctic, Building the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. The exhibit, timed to coincide with the 20th anniversary of the pipeline, features a 21-foot section of the pipeline supplemented by stories from oil workers and Alaska Natives, art photographs, maps, and a 30-foot timeline. But the field exhibit, which gives a rosy-eyed view of the 800-mile-long pipeline, has been sponsored to the tune of $300,000 by the Alyeska Services Pipeline Company, a consortium of ARCO, British Petroleum, and Exxon that operates the pipeline. Today, we're joined by my co-host in New York, Juan Gonzalez. He's a columnist with the New York Daily News and a contributor to In These Times magazine. Welcome, Juan.
Good day, Amy, and good day to our listeners.
And I want to welcome our guests. We're joined first by Russell McIver, editor of Corporate Crime Reporter, a weekly publication that surveys corporate wrongdoing. And we're joined as well by Adam Colton of the Alaska Wilderness League, an environmental group based in Washington, D.C. Russell, both you and Adam had a chance to go to the opening of the Alaska Pipeline exhibit, Oil from the Arctic. What was it like?
Well, Amy, when I first got there, I saw it on the day book, and it said some kind of celebration by the Smithsonian of the building of the 20th anniversary building of the pipeline. And I first got there, there were stretch limousines out front. I saw oil executives with their name tags, ARCO, Exxon, BP, and so forth, and their spouses. A lot of wine and beer flowing. And my first impression was, am I at the Smithsonian or am I at the American Petroleum Institute? I realized quickly that I was at the Smithsonian. That's where I had walked to. And it was a celebration. And it was an eye-opener. You and I have been doing this kind of reporting for a long time, and we know that corporate America has pretty much taken over the city. But the Smithsonian is a public institution. And it gets $370 million in public funds. That's money from you and I and every citizen in this country. It's acting, under the current secretary, Michael Heyman, it's acting as if it's a some kind of corporate PR outfit. It's Heyman is transforming the Smithsonian into the Epcot Center on the Potomac, I think, or a Disneyland kind of thing where corporations come in, they put down their money, and they get the PR exhibit that they want. Now, I think the problem here is that Heyman learned his lesson from a previous episode. That was in the early 90s when the American Chemical Society donated $5.3 million to fund a project called Science in American Life. And the curator actually did a level-headed job. The curator presented Rachel Carson and DDT and the downside of science and technology. As a result, the American Chemical Society created this huge uproar and said, okay, we're going to tell all chemical companies never to contribute anything to the Smithsonian again. Heyman learned the lesson from that and said, from now on, we're going to present, when we get corporate money, we're going to present the corporate point of view. So we have an exhibit that, and in the press kit, you see, they gave us this picture of a native Alaskan worker woman who's smiling. There's color photos of the pipeline. There's a section called Working with Nature. And it totally ignores the serious problems of the pipeline, the continuing harassment of whistleblowers who raise safety and health concerns. It downplays the Exxon Valdez spill, and you know, there's a little paragraph about it, no photo showing the destruction. So it's a dishonest job by the Smithsonian, and Heyman should be ashamed of himself.
Well, Russell, in terms of those people who say, well, you know, the amount of money for museums now, especially from government or foundations, has been reduced so much. What is wrong with having some of these corporations fork up this money for these exhibits?
Well, the thing that is wrong, Juan, is that this is a public institution. And it's time that the leaders of public institutions in America draw a strong, bright line saying we are public institutions. We will not take corporate monies. Because even though some people say you can take corporate monies and do an honest job, as in the case of Science in American Life exhibit, which is currently at the Smithsonian, there is always the payback. There is, you know, if you do it once, you will never get the money again. And that's what's going on here. So when you go up to Congress, you cannot appear to be a shill for the industry, because then your reputation is totally undermined. And that's what Heyman is acting like. He's acting as a shill for the industry, taking $300,000 plus the money for the party, which, you know, was a very fancy party and probably cost tens of thousands of dollars, and then presenting a dishonest exhibit where the serious problems of the pipeline were seriously downplayed.
I do want to say that we invited the Smithsonian to be on the show today. We talked with a number of representatives from the Smithsonian. We tried to get Jeffrey Stein, who's the curator of engineering and environmental history at the museum and of this particular exhibit, art from oil from the Arctic. We also tried to get a representative from Alyeska, the pipeline company. I called up to Anchorage and talked to Jennifer Rice, who is the head of corporate communications there. She said this wasn't really worth her time. But the Smithsonian said they weren't going to debate this issue. Let me ask our other guest, Adam Colton. You put out a press release on the day of the party for the opening of the Smithsonian exhibit, and you handed it out there. You were at the party. You actually went to the exhibit before it opened as a representative of Alaska Wilderness League here in Washington, D.C.
Well, I mean, the curator was very concerned when we called about what environmental groups might think of the exhibit, and did invite us to come in and showed us some of the exhibit before it had actually all been laid out. From what little we saw, there were some troubling things right at the outset. One is that for more information, museum goers are asked to go to Alyeska's website. Or the Tourism Council of Alaska's website. There was no opposing website, no place where museum goers could get information about the problems of the pipeline and oil development in Alaska. The most troubling thing, though, about the exhibit is the way it's being used by Alyeska, ARCO, British Petroleum, Exxon. They're trying to advance a political agenda here in Washington. You know, they're not just funding this exhibit to celebrate 20 years of the pipeline. I mean, they have a very specific legislative agenda, which involves trying to get Congress to pass legislation allowing drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. They're trying to open up the National Petroleum Reserve in Alaska, 23 million acre reserve on the western side of America's Arctic. They basically want the American people to believe that they can be trusted to drill in some of our most fragile and sensitive wild areas. And unfortunately, the exhibit does little to present both sides, little to present the persistent problems of the pipeline. There are 500 spills a day at Prudhoe Bay. 11 million gallons of oil spilled into Prince William Sound, that the Sound still hasn't recovered from that spill. I mean, can you imagine, as an historian, if you're going to take an honest look at the history of oil development in Alaska, wouldn't you at least include a photograph of the Exxon Valdez oil spill? There's one sentence mentioning the Exxon Valdez oil spill in four sentences talking about the steps Alyeska took to make changes in their spill response after the spill. So that, I think that tells the whole picture right there.
Amy,
I'd like to ask, given that the Exxon Valdez spill was arguably one of the greatest environmental disasters in U.S. history, what has been the response of people in Alaska, of civic groups in Alaska, to this kind of exhibit?
Well, I mean, most people in Alaska, with the exception of the oil industry lobbyists who flew down here, couldn't be at this exhibit. I mean, it's taking place in Washington, not in Alaska. But I would say that, you know, you have to...
But wouldn't the civic organizations at least know that of its existence?
I mean, they do. But, you know, you have to remember that the Exxon Valdez oil spill was really tragic, and people, environmental groups in Alaska are opposed to it, but the majority of citizens in Alaska have an enormous stake in the oil industry. I mean, they've profited greatly from every citizen in Alaska gets a check for $1,100 a year from petroleum dividend funds. So overall, what the industry wants is what the people of Alaska want.
Amy, if I could interject here, when I was speaking for this story with one of the representatives of the Smithsonian, they acted as if there was absolutely nothing wrong with this. She said, just walk around the Smithsonian. There are exhibits by the American Chemical Society, by Pepsi. You know, it's become sort of an institution of the Fortune 500, and that's what's distressing. We knew that corporations were making inroads into our public institutions. What was distressing at this event was the celebration of it. There was no shame. There was no stigma. You had representatives of the Smithsonian lauding representatives of ARCO, for example, the woman who was there representing ARCO, saying, we hope that this will be an ongoing, continual relationship. And she got up, and what she was most proud of was that this exhibit, which celebrates the construction of this pipeline, was in a high traffic area where a lot of children would see it. So that's what's distressing. It was this, you know, the Smithsonian is a wonderful institution, especially for children. And Heyman, the secretary, is turning it into some kind of PR expo.
I should say we've just been joined by a third guest, and he is Charles Hamill. People may remember Charles Hamill from a few years ago, particularly people from Alaska. Charles Hamill became a very significant figure, the highlight of congressional hearings a few years ago when it came to the activities of the Alyeska pipeline. He was the target of an undercover operation that Wackenhut Corporation, a worldwide security company hired by Alyeska, conducted against him. Investigators combed through his garbage, set up a bogus environmental group called Ecolit, tapped his phones, computer searched his telephone records, and sent women I don't know if that one's been actually proven. I'm going to ask you that in a second. But Charles Hamill, before we get to all that, you've walked into the studio with a bottle of what?
This is a jar that I just brought back from Alaska. It's a jar of some of the oil that's still on the beach in Prince William Sound. You notice the date on that, Amy, is, I believe,
3/8/97.
That was just when I was up there a few months ago.
This is the beach?
This is the beach, and if it's been...
Looks like a little like molasses,
well,
folks.
It looks like molasses, but it's been opened a few times, Amy. So you open it, and you smell it, and you tell me what you smell.
Come on, you're going to have to take over if I faint. Just oil.
It's oil. And what I just walked in and I heard a gentleman speaking of the children at going to the Smithsonian and seeing this great marvel, which the pipeline is a marvel, but they did make some mistakes. And one of the mistakes I find is if you go to many middle schools in America, the Alyeska and its parents are promoting a lot of video, a lot of data showing that the oil spill has been cleaned up, and there is no problem anymore. And I just happened to be bringing a jar from an area that they don't want to look at. There's a number of areas like this that have not been able to be cleaned up. They'll be there for 20 years. And I think it's unfortunate that the children are getting a skewed view of what reality is all about.
We're going to go to a break, and then when we come back, Charles Hamel, we want to hear your story as a former oil broker who became a whistleblower around what was going on in Alaska, particularly the Alyeska oil pipeline, how you were targeted, and then we'll find out from all of you who went over to the exhibit if the story is told in the Smithsonian exhibit that opened 3 weeks ago, Oil from the Arctic, the story of the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. It is the 20th anniversary of the pipeline. We've been joined by Russell McIver, who's with Corporate Crime Reporter, also Adam Colton, who's with the Alaska Wilderness League, and Charles Hamel, a former oil broker. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. This is Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I am Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez, and we're talking about the new Smithsonian Institution exhibition that has opened on the 20th year history of the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. It's called Oil from the Arctic, Building the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. We're joined by Russell McIver, editor of Corporate Crime Reporter, who did a very interesting piece on the exhibit in issue a couple of weeks ago. Also, Adam Colton from the Alaska Wilderness League, and Charles Hamel, a former oil broker and whistleblower who, despite intense harassment by Alyeska, provided crucial information about corrosion on the Trans-Alaska Pipeline to the media and Congress, which led to, something to the tune of $1 million worth of corrections on that pipeline. Is that true, Charles Hamel?
Hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars. They're near $1 billion now.
But tell us about this operation to destroy you that Alyeska engaged in and was forced to admit in the congressional hearing.
Well, I was actually a vehicle for the whistleblowers on the pipeline because I'm a businessman, and I passed information on to the government, to the EPA, and to the Congress. And the problem was the corporate culture at Alyeska is shoot the messenger, and they were out to find the messengers, and they came after me spending a fortune, undercover ladies and undercover people from the Walking Hood Corporation. They parked in front of my home in Alexandria with a van, picked off our phones, picked up our trash every Wednesday night. They entered my home. They attempted a lot of things. They picked up my mail, unopened mail. They did a lot of things, always to discover who the whistleblowers were, not correct the problems that they had, but find the whistleblowers.
Set up a fake environmental group?
Oh, they sure did. They had five of the ladies who were involved came over in the end and became Chucky's Angels, they were called. They became, to my wife and I, they came and told us what was going on by Walking Hood and Alyeska. They were out to achieve one purpose, was find and search and destroy the whistleblowers. And the whistleblowers finally, in the end, in front of hearings that Congressman Miller had and then Congressman Dingell, different hearings that proved that there were thousands of violations of the code, but serious matters. And the oil company of executives came and testified that they agreed that, thank God for the whistleblowers, that they were able to solve some of the problems and go correct them. You're talking near $1 billion.
What were some of those? What were some of those major violations that you were able to uncover?
Well, there were a number of them that had to do with electrical problems, hundreds and hundreds of electrical problems, any one of which could cause a serious explosion, and the pipeline, of course, would be leaking. And they were at the pump stations and at the Valdez terminal, and they were serious enough that the oil company officials themselves were frightened as they accepted the hearings that this had been going on, and at their middle management level, it was that was killed a messenger. We don't do anything wrong. Everything's all right, and hide it all. If you know that, you know, a great deal, 20% of our oil, I think, comes from Alaska. You pop that pipeline, and you have a real problem. We all learned that with the Exxon Valdez.
Well, subsequent to your testimony, there was some sort of employee concern program set up to be able to provide some kind of access for whistleblowers to get their message out without any kind of harassment. Has that been successful at all?
Unfortunately, that was set up, and the Congress forced that upon the Interior Department, who has oversight. And the problem was, they just recently, a few weeks ago, they've been at it again. The same lawyer who was involved in my case and involved the case of all these whistleblowers that I have hidden, there are a number of his whistleblowers that have never been identified, and they just went into his computer system of the employees concerns manager at Alyeska just a few weeks ago and picked off all the data in there of data from employees who are sending email messages of concerns that they have on the pipeline and with their managers.
Russell McIver, you wrote about this in the Corporate Crime Reporter. Ultimately, the CEO of Alyeska, on the eve of the Smithsonian exhibition opening, was forced to apologize for this.
Yes, absolutely. Now, Amy, I think this makes the exact point that we're trying to make, that had the Smithsonian highlighted the work of this courageous man, Chuck Hamel, had they had pictures of, as Adam says, of the Exxon spill to show the young kids who are walking through that exhibit, the reality, next to the wonder of this pipeline, the construction of this pipeline, then it would have been a fair exhibit. But then the ARCO and Exxon and BP executives would not have been at that party celebrating the exhibit. It would have been an honest exhibit, and they would want nothing to do with it. That's the problem with corporate funding, and that's the problem with the direction Hayman is taking the Smithsonian.
I have to ask one question, and it's about Charles Hamel. I read your story all over the place in clippings that I got from 1991 and 1992, profiles of you in the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times. But I didn't see a profile in the Washington Post and asked you about that. And you said they actually came out and wrote a story about you, but ultimately it was killed.
There were several stories that were killed on the 11th hour, the night before. Each time they sent photographers and they interviewed me days on end. They telephoned across the country. In each case, the morning of, I got a phone call from the reporter saying my story was killed. I believe I understand why. The Walkenhut Corporation is...
That was hired by Alyeska to attack you.
That's correct.
Investigate you.
They came to see, the head of Walkenhut came to see the Washington Post officials just before the congressional hearings in 60 Minutes and all the hullabaloo started. And the story was killed. And each reporter said that they've killed it because of their friendship with the Walkenhut Corporation. What's damaging about that, members of Congress are still unaware of what happened here in Washington, D.C. to my wife and I over a one-year period by Alyeska, some of the incredible things that were done to us. And members of the Congress and their staff have no knowledge of that. And so, obviously, the folks at the Smithsonian don't either.
So today you are a resource for whistleblowers?
I had taken a sabbatical for a while. They've ruined my wife and I, our lives, and we're taking a sabbatical for a moment.
Well, what made you, as a businessman, take these kinds of risks and continue to persist in this campaign over what the oil companies are doing in Alaska?
Well, I was in the oil business up there, and I had run a super tanker operation into Valdez, and they were cheating in the lab department on the data of the oil was going into my tanker. And when I learned that, I also learned from the staff that they had to cheat on the environment, and they had to falsify documents and falsify lab tests. And I just couldn't put up with that, and that's how I got involved. And once you get involved with whistleblowers, and you have to keep their names and their persons, their families protected, you get caught into the maze. And as a businessman, no one understands why I continue doing it. I'm supposed to be in the oil business. I have interest up on the North Slope. But it was wrong, and it's also dangerous. If that pipeline were to pop, we're all going to pay a terrible price.
Adam Colton, you're with the Alaska Wilderness League, and as we wrap up this discussion, I wanted to wrap it up on the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, what you call UNWAR?
Well, I don't call it UNWAR because it sounds too much like an oil field. I like to get the words Arctic National and Wildlife Refuge in there, but it's America's Arctic Refuge. and it belongs to, you know, every American. And the oil companies, they want to have access to this last 5% of America's North Slope that's still off limits to oil drilling. And as Mr. Hamill said, you know, I mean, the oil companies really can't be trusted to with their record to go into these sensitive wilderness areas. We ought to have at least one small piece of America's Arctic there for future generations. And I think if people who are listening really care about what's being said, they can make a difference by rejecting Alyeska, British Petroleum, ARCO, and Exxon's agenda here, and call their member of Congress and ask them to support legislation now before Congress to permanently protect the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge.
Russell McIver.
You know, we've all heard that the Alaska congressional delegation is in the pocket of the oil industry, but at this party at the Smithsonian, each of them stood up and lauded the oil companies and lauded Alyeska. And Senator Murkowski made the point that this was just the first step, that they wanted to get into the wildlife refuge. And I think that one of the reasons that Alyeska did this was for political spin, to make them look good, so when the fight comes in Congress, they'll have some more ammo on this fight.
It's interesting. I asked Alyeska about that, and the representative said, I was one of the people who pushed for the $300,000 to go to this Smithsonian exhibit, and said, I didn't think about that. Well, I am very sorry that Alyeska wasn't able to join us. I'm very sorry that the Smithsonian chose not to join us, but I'm glad that the three of you did. And I have to say, this whole discussion about corporate control and corporate contributions to public institutions makes me think about public broadcasting and how ultimately the same effect is had. If you take away taxpayer funding, public funding from these institutions, it's not just that it's saving the taxpayer money, as some like to say, but it's that you've got increasing corporate control of these public institutions. Thanks very much for being with us. Adam Colton of the Alaska Wilderness League, an environmental group based in Washington. Your phone number, if people want to reach you, or your website?
It's 202-544-5205 or 800-322-5205.
That 800 number again?
It's 1-800-322-5205.
And if people want to get a hold of the corporate crime reporter, Russell McIver?
202-737-1680.
Again?
202-737-1680.
And Charles Hamill of Northern Virginia, former oil broker and whistleblower.
On the internet, I'm at C. Hamill, C-H-A-M-E-L, at CompuServe.com. C. Hamill, C-H-A-M-E-L, at CompuServe.com.
Thank you very much for joining us. And Juan Gonzalez, New York Daily News, and in these times, thanks for being with us from New York.
You're
listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! After a short break, we bring you an unprecedented discussion by two sides in the Northern Ireland conflict. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. For most of the last 28 years, Northern Ireland has been at war. On the one side stands the Irish Republican Army and other organizations generally called nationalists or republicans who are fighting for a united Ireland and against official discrimination towards Catholics and Irish nationalists in the British-ruled province. On the other side stands the British Army and their allies in Northern Ireland, the so-called Unionists or Loyalists. They wish to remain under British rule or part of the Union of Great Britain and Northern Ireland. The Unionists, who are generally Protestant, descend from colonial settlers who moved into the northeastern part of Ireland in the 17th and 18th centuries, and they presently hold the economic and political power in the six counties. The war, by any measure, has been expensive, dramatic, and bloody, claiming more than 3,000 lives over the last two decades. But in recent years, representatives of the IRA have begun talking to the British government, a process that has now led to an IRA ceasefire and full-fledged peace talks. But the bitterness remains, especially among many Unionist forces who until recently refused to even be in the same negotiating room as the IRA or their representatives. Today on Democracy Now!, we bring you for the first time in a national broadcast in the United States, a discussion with senior representatives from both sides of the political divide in Northern Ireland. Both were in the United States for a conference this past weekend at Hunter College, part of the City University of New York, marking the 150th anniversary of the Irish potato famine. We were joined by Mary Nellis, who is a city councillor from Derry in Northern Ireland. She represents Sinn Féin, the political party tied to the Irish Republican Army, which has been fighting for a united Ireland. Her four sons have all served prison sentences for politically related convictions, including armed activity. And we're joined by Billy Hutchinson, a city councillor from Belfast, representing the Progressive Unionist Party, which supports a continuation of British rule in Northern Ireland. He served 16 years in prison after he was convicted of murdering two Catholic teenagers. He was formerly a member of the Ulster Volunteer Force, the UVF, a paramilitary group that launched frequent and bloody armed assaults against the nationalist community. We began with Mary Nellis for her comment on the peace process today.
The peace process, well, I think it's the best opportunity to try and bring about a resolution to the ongoing conflict in Ireland. Some people say the ongoing conflict for the last 30 years. I prefer to look at it in terms of a historical conflict of 900 years, and particularly in the contemporary situation of partition. From 1921 until now, there has been ongoing conflict in the north of Ireland. And so this peace process, to me, is the best opportunity of trying to bring a resolution to that ongoing conflict. And it simply means that all the parties to the conflict, the British government, the Dublin government, the various political representatives of the various parties, both from the unionist and the nationalist tradition, are now involved together in talks. And the talks are arranged in a series of strands called Strand 1, Strand 2. And Strand 1 is where all the parties get together. Strand 2 is where the two sovereign governments get together and try and work out a solution.
Mary Nellis, what would you like to see as a Republican, as a Sinn Féin council member? What would you like to see the result of the peace process be?
Well, of course, I'd like to see that it would begin the road to a process that would bring an end to conflict in Ireland. I'd like to see people talking about how they're going to resolve their differences. Certainly as a member of Sinn Féin, we'd be putting our analysis forward, and our analysis would be that a unified Ireland is the best option, that the six-county state has failed, that it's in the best interest of all the people of Ireland, north and south, from the various traditions, to be part of a unified Ireland, and that the process involved in making peace and trying to bring about a resolution of the conflict should be free from the outside interference of England.
Billy Hutchinson, you're a city council member in Belfast, in addition to being a spokesperson for the Progressive Unionist Party. What do you think of that?
Well, I mean, I think that I would agree with what Mary's saying to a certain degree, but I think that what we need to be doing is that we need to find a process where we stay within the United Kingdom, but we have some form of Irish input into it, and it needs to be sort of written into statute to make sure that there is the Irish people have an Irish political dimension. And I feel that that can be done in the context of the British Isles, which can deal with the periphery of being on the edge of the European Union, because I do think that come 1989, Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland are going to be totally exposed in terms of Europe and economically, and I think that we have to actually start dealing with that.
Why don't you think Ireland should be unified?
I don't think Ireland should be unified, because I think what happens then is that I lose my Britishness. I'm a British citizen and someone who believes in the whole British way of life, and I would lose that under a united Ireland. I don't think that I would have it, but I do think that I can retain that and can also, I suppose, have an Irish dimension from Dublin within my own society.
Explain a little more what it means to be a British citizen to you.
Well, what it means to me to be a British citizen is I was born in Northern Ireland, which is the northeastern corner of Ireland. All my life it has been a part of the United Kingdom. I grew up in the northeast, as I say. It's a very industrialised place, Belfast, and it's similar to what it is in Northern England. And I feel that I have more in common with people in Northern England than I would in Southern Ireland. But in saying that, I have a lot in common with all those Republicans and Nationalists who share the island with me in the North, and I'm sure they have more in common with me than they do with people in the South. So what I want to try and find is some way of uniting people in the North, but at the same time being able to keep the both identities in terms of Britishness and Irishness.
How was this past weekend for you in New York City when you were on a panel with a number of Republicans? I mean, here you were in the British paramilitary in Northern Ireland. Many of the people who are in the audience were probably your targets, your military targets. How do you reconcile that?
Well, I mean, you know, in the past I was involved in what's called loyalist paramilitaries. And I think we all have to take the blame for what's happened in Northern Ireland. There's none of us totally innocent and none of us are totally guilty. We've all played our part, just as there would have been people, and particularly people belonging to Murray's party and probably Murray's family would have been targets of organisations that I was in. I was targets of their organisations as well. But I mean, I think that particularly the Loyalists and particularly the Loyalist parties in Sinn Féin have come to accept that whatever happened in the past, we all have to deal with it and we have to move on. We can't allow our past to hold that back. And, you know, there are plenty of Republicans who I have admiration for, and the reason why I have admiration for them is that they were prepared to put their lives in the line to fight what they believed in. Now, you know, so I accept that, and I also say to people, you know, what we need to do now is take the gun out of Irish politics, and that's what we're about trying to do, and that will mean having to speak to people who we have been trying to kill and also speak to people who have tried to kill us. But I think that there's no other way forward, and what we have to do is move into the future. And we wouldn't be talking if we were all friends. I mean, the whole reason why we're talking is because we've been political enemies, you know, for the last how many years, 800, you know, 70 or whatever it is. And I think we need to change that.
What do you see you have in common with Republicans?
Well, I think that what I have in common with Republicans is I suppose that I have a shared experience of poverty, a shared experience of culture, a shared experience of injustice. And I think that all of those things is enough to bring us together. But unfortunately, the biggest thing in Northern Ireland is the constitutional position of whether you remain British or whether you're Irish politically. And I think that that's what divides us. But I think that quite a lot of other things we do have in common. You know, we all suffer from, as I have already said.
Billy Hutchinson, a loyalist city council member from Belfast, member of the Ulster Volunteer Force, or UVF, served 16 years in prison for murdering two Catholic teenagers. And Mary Nealis, city councillor from Derry. She represents Sinn Féin, and we'll come back with both of them in just a minute in this unprecedented conversation on radio. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. As we continue with our discussion with Billy Hutchinson, city councillor from Belfast, former member of the Ulster Volunteer Force, a paramilitary group that launched frequent and bloody armed assaults against the nationalist community, and Mary Nealis, a city councillor from Derry representing Sinn Féin. Her four sons have all served prison sentences for politically related convictions, including armed activity.
Mary Nealis, how do you feel sitting across the table from Billy Hutchinson, part of a paramilitary force that targeted you, your family, your friends, killed people?
Well, I see Billy Hutchinson as part of the of the British war machine in the north of Ireland. I see that he, that his organisation and the things that he did, or his organisation did particularly, were brought about by the British involvement in Ireland, where Britain set up a conflictual situation that brought people together in a situation where they killed each other. And so I don't have any particular difficulties about addressing Billy Hutchison's paramilitary activities, nor do they have any difficulty in talking with his organisation, because they believe that at the end of the day, and they said this during my presentation at Hunter College, that the British government have not assimilated the people of the north of Ireland from either tradition, that they see us as Irish, that our shared experience that Billy Hutchison talked about give us more in common and a better sense of identity than anything that the British government have ever offered us, that the British government have always treated the north of Ireland as one of its colonies, as a place apart. I think they've always treated the people there. They set up the conditions of conflict, not Billy Hutchison or his organisation, not the IRA, not Republicans. The British government are... their presence in Ireland is the root cause of the conflict, and they have created conditions where people like from organisations on both sides, paramilitary organisations on both sides, have been put into conflict and find necessity to kill each other. Now, these talks that we're involved in the moment, I sincerely hope, will enable us to have the space to put all those issues on the table and examine them. I don't see any difficulty at all about ever upholding Billy Hutchison, British identity. If Billy Hutchison and the people that he represents wish to have a British identity within the context of a new Ireland, and I not say a united Ireland, because I think that terminology sometimes threatens people, but I'm talking about a new Ireland, a democratic Ireland, because we've never had democracy in Ireland, either north or south. And I think that Billy Hutchison would agree with me that he's working at a grassroots level to create a democratic structure, and whatever that may be, we will certainly explore all those issues within the talks framework.
What is your assessment of Mary McAleese, Ireland's new president-elect, who is from Northern Ireland?
Well, I think she was the best person for the job. If you're looking at terms of qualifications, she's a lawyer. She was vice-chancellor of Queen's University. I think she's a very able woman. The fact that she happened to be a Northern nationalist provoked a very sectarian reaction from from people in the south of Ireland who would see Northern Nationalists, both Billy Hutchison and Northern Unionists, as people sort of to be kept apart. They didn't want to be involved in it. I think that it was absolutely racist, the attacks that were made upon her, the spear campaign about her Northern accent, the fact that this cosy cartel, which is a result of partition of 26 counties, wants to remain apart from the north of Ireland. And when I talk about creating a new structures for a new Ireland, I'm precisely dealing with the present partitioned entity, which is called the 26 counties, because I believe that there has to be fundamental political, social and economic changes down there too, and cultural change as well.
What do the British gain by being in Northern Ireland?
Well, I don't know. Maybe Billy might answer that better, because, I mean, at the moment, the subvention, that is the money that they're putting in to maintain this failed six-county entity, is something like £7.2 billion. I don't know what they're gaining from it. At the moment, the Blair government, is the new Labour government, is actually looking at breaking up the United Kingdom. They've given devolution to, or the people of Scotland have actually voted for devolution. The people of Wales have voted for devolution. Maybe they're looking at a devolved Northern Ireland, but that's not going to work, because we've had a devolved Northern Ireland for the last 70 years and it's failed miserably. So you have to look at something new there. So I don't know what they have to gain. Certainly, I think in the past we had the issue of their remaining in the north of Ireland for strategic interest for NATO. But several British Secretary of States in the past number of years have said publicly that they have no strategic, selfish or economic interest in remaining in the north of Ireland. So I think it's time they went.
Billy Hutchison, what do you see you have to gain by the British remaining in Northern Ireland?
Well, I think there's quite a number of things to be gained by the British government staying, I suppose, in Ireland. I think it's a different society than what it is in the Republic. I mean, the rest of the UK, excluding Northern Ireland, I mean, it's a pluralist society. I think that's what we need to move towards, a multicultural society. I think that, you know, in terms of the Republic of Ireland, they're far away behind that in terms of influence of the church and issues of divorce and all of this are things that are really being tackled now in the Republic of Ireland. All of these things were tackled in the rest of the UK quite a while ago, and I think that that's where we benefit from. I also think that we benefit economically in terms of, you know, we're better off within the United Kingdom than you would be in the Republic of Ireland in terms of economics. But in terms of why the British are there, I mean, I think that, you know, they have the reasons why they're there, I suppose, are more about in terms of, you know, that they can't walk away from something where there's 1.5 million people. I'm not disagreeing with Marianne saying that they probably haven't caused quite a lot of the problems, but they also need to know that they also know that they have to resolve them, and they also know that they have the responsibility for the security of 1.5 million people. And they will remain there until they're sure that security is safe. And, you know, I don't believe it'll be an 8 of Ireland in my lifetime. I think that the only way it's going to be brought about is not by British withdrawal, but by some form of referendum, which the majority of people say that they want the United Ireland. And I think that when that comes in, we all have to try and work to find ways of making sure that that new Ireland is pluralist.
We're talking to Billy Hutchinson and Mary Nealis. Billy Hutchinson, a Belfast city councillor. He is the spokesperson for the Progressive Unionist Party. He is a unionist, considers himself a British citizen. Mary Nealis is a council member from Derry in 6 counties of Northern Ireland and is a Republican. She is a Sinn Féin council member. What about the role of the U.S. government? What do you see the role of the people of this country and the government in the peace process, Mary?
Well, there's supposed to be 44 million people in the United States who would claim some ethnic Irish origins, and I think those people have a fundamental role to play in trying to influence the US government, that they themselves should be, and their spokesperson should be, putting pressure on the British government to, first of all, I think they have been influential in setting up the talks process. I think the US government, some statesperson, I think President Clinton himself was the first American president to stick his neck out to try and bring some resolution to conflict in Ireland. So they have a role, you know, and that role is to put in place, or to influence the British government to put in place the conditions that might bring a resolution to the conflict. Other than that, I think that the Irish people have to resolve their own problems with outside interference, and whether that be British or United States, then as far as I'm concerned, that's what has to be done. I appreciate those people, the congressmen, the senators, the president, the Irish Americans who are interested enough to make an input into the present day peace process. I think that after that, then they've got to leave it up to us and let us do
Billy Hutchinson.
The working out.
Yeah, well, I think that the role that the American government have played up to now has been one of facilitator, and I think that that is their role. I don't think that they have a direct role in a sense where they would be interfering, but I think that they do have a role of facilitation, and I think that that's marked by the late Ron Brown and Chuck Meisner, who were people who came to Northern Ireland and had actually worked out an economic program where they were going to try and encourage investment to come from corporate America, and they did that to some success, and I think that it's a tribute to them that they were able to do that. And obviously Ron Brown and Chuck Meisner, both Ron Brown was the Secretary of Commerce who was killed in the plane, I think it was in the former Yugoslavia,
right?
And Chuck Meisner was killed with him as well. And those were two people who had come to Northern Ireland and had worked quietly in the background while peace was trying to be built. And, in terms of economic regeneration. And also George Mitchell, the former senator, who's been chairing the talks. And, so all their contributions has been great. The consulate in Belfast, and I suppose the embassy in London and the embassy in Dublin, have been people who have been continually working to try and encourage both sides to stick at the peace process.
Did you agree with President Clinton allowing Gerry Adams into the country, head of Sinn Féin?
Well, I mean, I think that, this is one of the problems that we have. The problem is that if the Americans are going to make decisions about Republicans, they must make the same decisions about Loyalists. And we don't have a problem if they're making decisions that are of equal basis. But, I mean, they must continue. And there's no reason why Gerry Adams shouldn't have came here. But, I mean, it has to be made. It must be even-handed that they must look at what they're going to do if a Loyalist actually asks from one of the Loyalist parties, particularly from my party, if we want to enter America, will we get entry? And, that is what it's based on, as long as they're going to be even-handed.
Billy Hutchinson, can you talk about your life in the paramilitary? What did you do? How did you end up there?
Well, I mean, it's quite difficult to talk about it for obvious reasons. I joined the Loyalist paramilitary because I thought that The IRA were trying to bomb me in the United Ireland.
How old were you?
I was 16.
Mm-hmm. And which group did you join?
I joined a group called the Ulster Volunteer Force.
Uh-huh. And what did you do within it?
Well, I mean, I was involved in activities which I wouldn't want to go into in the air. I went to prison for quite a long time.
How long?
Well, I spent 16 years in prison. But, I mean, you know, I think it, you know, Mary has made the point. There were people who were in prison who weren't guilty of all the things that they did. And, you know, I don't think this is a place to go into it, you know. I have been out 7 years now, and what I'm trying to do is put my past behind me.
Do you regret any... Do you regret your involvement now?
No, I wouldn't say I would regret my involvement. I was involved because I believed that what I did was right. What I'm trying to do now is that I'm trying to build some sort of peace between the people in Northern Ireland. And, you know, I think that we need to move ahead. But you know, I don't think that any of my involvement in the past was wrong. I believed in what I did was right. And, you know, I will do what all I can now to change our society and to make sure the society that I grew up in is changed and it's a better place for my children.
Would you describe what you did with the Ulster paramilitary group did as terrorism targeting civilians?
No, I don't see it as terrorism. When is a civilian not a civilian? I think that, you know, if, you know, we're going to argue here, I think that you need to understand what has happened over the last 30 years. I mean, you know, I've answered this question more times than enough over the weekend in terms of, you know, do the IRA kill civilians? And people seem to think that they don't. Now, I don't think that Murray would deny it. The IRA have never killed civilians. But it's a question of when is a civilian not a civilian? And I think that needs to be pointed out, you know, because there is a, you know, and I'm not disputing, I think it's dangerous to get into this talk about legitimate targets, but if somebody who's a mailman, who's a part-time soldier, and he's delivering mail, and he's ambushed by the IRA men, and he actually happens to draw a pistol and kill one of them, you know, that is perceived by, you know, some people in America as that, you know, it was a British soldier who killed an IRA man. But, I mean, I think that we have to be careful. And I think that legitimate targets and acceptable levels of violence are things that I wouldn't want to be justifying.
Would you like to add something to that, Mary Nellis?
Well, I'm going to go back to the sources of the conflict again, that that is responsible for creating organisations like both the Irish Republican Army and the Ulster Volunteer Force. And they both believe legitimately that they're fighting to defend what their political rights and a particular political position. I think that we could talk for 30 years of all the things that's happened in Ireland, and prior to that we could talk from the state of Northern Ireland, because those particular organisations didn't come into being in 1969. The UVF was there in 1912. The Irish Republican Army had been there since 1916. So historically, there always has been conflicting paramilitary organisations who were defending whatever political rights that they felt they needed to defend in Ireland. So at the end of the day, you've got to look at, you know, root causes of the conflict. And the root causes of the conflict, as far as I'm concerned, as an Irish Republican, is the interference of England in the affairs of Ireland. That's all historically has been the root cause of the conflict, and since 1921, and particularly since 1969.
Mary Nealis and Billy Hutchinson. Mary Nealis, city councillor from Derry, representing Sinn Féin, the political party tied to the Irish Republican Army, which has been fighting for a united Ireland. Her four sons have all served prison sentences for politically related convictions. Billy Hutchinson, a city councillor from Belfast, representing the Progressive Unionist Party, which supports a continuation of British rule in Northern Ireland. They were both invited by the Irish Famine Genocide Committee. You can reach them on the web at www.ifgc.org. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. You can reach us by email at democracy@pacifica.org. The music from the original motion picture soundtrack of Sun, Mother, Son, which is about Bobby Sands and the IRA hunger strikers in the 1980s. Democracy Now! Is produced by Dan Coughlin. Andy York and Errol Maitland are our engineers. Julie Drizin is our executive producer. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.